Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome back, folks. Joining us is Clancy Dubose, political editor and columnist for Gambit and WWL-TV, political analyst. Every year he typically issues the top 10 political stories of the previous year, and he's done so again this year, and he joins us to discuss same. Clancy, hope you had a great New Year's celebration, and welcome.
Thank you, Newell. We had a low-key New Year's celebration because of the pandemic, and I just got back last night from 3 days at Manresa, so I had a very peaceful New Year myself.
There you go. So you're rested and ready to go then.
I am. Right now, I feel nice to everybody, but we'll see how long that lasts. You know what that feeling's like.
Absolutely, my friend, absolutely. Interesting year, 2021, on so many different fronts, right?
Yes. In fact, when I did my annual top 10 stories, I couldn't get it down to just 10, so I did the top 10 plus 2. Because there were just that many, you know, it was a strange and eventful year, as we all know. And sometimes it's fun to go back and look at it, and sometimes it can be a little painful. It was a mixture of both of those this past year.
You know, you and I discussed this several times over the year. As in the world of politics, so many of the traditional practices and the way that you campaign, operate elections and the like over the past 2 years were completely disrupted.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of those changes may last. We'll see. You know, they were changing anyway because of social media and the way that people communicate now via social media and the internet. And, you know, the slow disappearance of various old school ways of communicating. But that's been the story of American politics throughout. As media changes, as technology changes, campaigning change. And the pandemic certainly had a similar effect to, let's say, the effect that, say, World War II had on professional sports. Some sports, you know, canceled for a little while and came back later. Just as sports changes and technology changes, politics has to change too. Candidates have to adapt because to run for office, you can't expect people to come where you are. You have to go where they are if you're a candidate. And the pandemic certainly was a glaring example of that.
No, absolutely. So let's get into the stories, the top 10 political stories of the year. 2021, the first story you have listed is the New Orleans sheriff's race, a new sheriff in town, Susan Hudson.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and when it comes to picking the top story, there's always several that you could pick. So this is kind of subjective, but I would say my top three stories could have all been the number one story. But Susan Hudson pulled off the upset of the season by beating 17-year incumbent Sheriff Marlon Gusman. Part of that was a rising tide of progressivism in New Orleans, but also was a reflection of the extremely small turnout. I believe if there had been a 35% turnout, Gusman might have won in the primary. And I think you could say that he didn't take her perhaps as seriously as some people, his supporters, would have wanted him to. Maybe he underestimated her. She certainly didn't appear to be at the outset a major challenge, but she, like Jason Williams, running for district attorney a year ago, got a huge infusion, about $1.5 million of progressive money, and when I say progressive, you know, left-leaning, far left-leaning money from individuals and entities that are supportive of a big umbrella of criminal justice reform, and that made a difference. Although, I have to point out, Jason Williams was already a major candidate a year ago when he ran for DA, but so that helped him as well. But I think we're seeing lower and lower turnouts. I don't know if that's just a COVID thing. We'll know when this pandemic is over if the turnout starts to go back up. But we had the smallest turnout, both in the primary and in the runoff, this election season. We had a 28% turnout in the primary, which was delayed. If you recall, the primary was originally scheduled for October 9th, but it was pushed back to November 13th, and then that pushed the runoff back to December 11th. So that affected it. It was pushed back because of Ida, and then the turnout, I think, was affected both by the fact that Mayor Cantrell did not have a major opponent, although she had lots of opponents, but none of them would qualify as a major opponent. And then in the runoff, we had a 22% turnout. I have not seen a turnout that low in the last 100 years for a mayor's race.
Yeah, it's a sad commentary, actually, you know, that so many people had fought so hard for our way of life here and the privilege and the rights that we have, none more important than the right to vote.
I believe that's correct on all counts.
Interesting. There's a long lame duck period. Ms. Hudson takes office, sheriff-elect, on May 2nd.
That's correct. We used to have the same thing for mayors, but now, and that's because sheriffs, as you know, are parochial offices, whereas the mayor is a municipal office, and state law governs both of those, but the sheriff, the clerks, we have two clerks, a clerk of civil court who was reelected without opposition, Ms. Napoleon, and then a new clerk at criminal court who was the chief elections officer, Darren Lombard, and they plus the new sheriff take office on the first Monday in May, which this year. I can't say next year anymore. We're in 22, yep. But this year that's May 2nd.
Right.
She's going to need it, I think, when you have a change in office this dramatic, because running that jail is a huge enterprise, and it's going to take Ms. Hudson some time to get her arms around that whole entity and all of the things that go with it. So she can't afford to waste any time during this transition.
A little curious, you make an observation about criminal justice landscape and whether or not it's going to change. We're seeing a lot of progressive mayors, DAs, and alike retreat off of some of their stances of defund the police, criminal justice reform. In fact, most recently, London Breed has really gone to the pulpit and has taken the complete opposite stance that she had just a year ago.
Yeah, well, they were further down the road than we are in New Orleans, and we'll have to see how that plays out here. We haven't fully instituted all of the aspects, I would say, of the San Francisco and New York style of criminal justice reform, and I'm not sure if that's what people intended to. We have to see what happens. I can say this, progressives in New Orleans now have pretty much control over the criminal justice system, from the police through the consent decree, the mayor, who was elected as a progressive. You can argue whether she's lived up to that because she's been in office now for almost 4 years. And by the way, the mayor and the council take office in less than a week. They take office next Monday, January 10th. And now they have the district attorney and the criminal sheriff. The sheriff. We have one sheriff in town. So there's no excuse for them not doing what they say they want to do. I think most people still don't have a real concrete idea of what that entails, although some people might who are involved in that effort. And, you know, I think the proof is in the pudding. It's like anything else. When somebody comes in and I'm making an analogy here, a historical reference, when Bobby Jindal came in, he said he's going to do ethics reform. And I don't know that our politics or our politicians are any more ethical now than they were. There's a lot more forms to fill out, but we'll see. And we'll see, I think, in the next couple of years, if crime goes down, I think you got to give it a chance. But people have a very short attention span and a very low level of tolerance when crime goes up, and crime is already going up. So I think they're going to have to deliver on their promises, or there will be a backlash. You can count on that.
Yeah, and that's what we're seeing across the country. Your second story, the mayor and the melee.
Yeah, or the malaise. Is it the melee? Or the, I think I said malaise.
Malaise, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, you know, she was reelected without any major opposition. That was predictable, but it's still important when a mayor gets reelected. And she had a huge margin, 65%, but as I mentioned earlier, that 28% turnout was the lowest in memory. And I think most voters voted with their feet. I think there was a lot of disenchantment with the mayor. Her numbers are still very good, but they're nowhere near the stratospheric approval levels that they were, you know, 6 months ago. But I think I think any politician out there would be happy to have a 60% or a little more than 60% approval record, and would be happy to get reelected with 65% of the vote, regardless of what the turnout is. And you know, she now has a chance to work with the new council. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But she talked about the malaise. You know, after Ida, there was kind of a feeling of people were beginning to lose hope. You know, the trash wasn't getting picked up, and lots of debris was in the streets, and Ida had come through, and the pandemic was here, and people were just worn out. And I think the mayor accurately described it. She said, we're in a malaise right now. But as the mayor, one of her jobs is to sort of jumpstart us and get us out of this malaise. A new year always brings new hope, so she's got a chance to do that. She takes office next week, and it'll be interesting to see what her message is to voters as she begins her second term.
The third story, COVID-19.
Yes, COVID. Again, any one of these first three stories could have been number one. They're all the top three. And as you mentioned, it changed everything from how candidates run for office to how we vote, how and where we cast our ballots. My precinct moved because there was damage to the polling place. And, of course, it has changed how we live and how we work. So it has been as big a disruption as the Internet has been to commerce. And we're not done with it yet.
No, not by any stretch. Obviously, Omicron has really, you know, delivered a curveball to a lot of the way that we typically have looked at the response to the pandemic.
Yes, it has. I mean, and as has been the case throughout, this is a very new virus, not just this particular variant, Omicron, I'm not sure what the right way to pronounce it is, but we know what it is. I'm calling it the O. But, even the scientists, the best scientists in the world, are learning more and more about this every day and every week. So people say, well, the information is contradictory. It's not so much that the information is contradictory, it's that the evidence comes to more and more evidence and comes to light about what the properties are of this pandemic. And each variant, I believe, is a little bit different. Some are stronger. This one appears to be more, I think the word is virulent. It spreads faster, much faster than any of its predecessors, but there is evidence that perhaps it's not as lethal. Part of that, I think, is because a lot of people have gotten vaccinated and boosted, and then there's been a certain amount of herd immunity. And under the best of circumstances, and I'm not predicting this, but I think under the best of circumstances, there have been people who've speculated that, and maybe hoped, that this one will spread very quickly and infect a lot of people, but it won't be as lethal and perhaps not be as harsh, although for some it is. There are a lot of children. We've lost 1,000 children to Omicron. So that's a real telling thing. But it, as fast as it rises, as it did in South Africa, it fell off real quickly, too, because it's not everybody, but a whole lot of people got it. And when you get to a certain percentage, I don't know what it is, but a certain measure of herd immunity sets in. You know, I would hope that more people would just get vaccinated, and that would give us the immunity that we need, or at least the resistance to the more harmful strains. But we'll see how that plays out, because we're not there yet.
Absolutely. All right, we got to get to a break. 504-260-1870 on the Open Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. We're visiting with Clancy Dubose, political editor and columnist for Gambit and WWL-TV political analyst. We're discussing the top 10 political stories of 2021, plus two. We had difficulty keeping it to 10. It's actually 12. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. Clancy Dubose joins us, political editor and columnist for Gambit and WWL-TV political analyst. We're talking about his top 10 political stories of 2021, plus two, actually, this year. So we get a bonus. We're on number four, Louisiana's first veto override session. That was an unusual happenstance.
First one ever. Historic. And basically, Governor Edwards, of course, he's a Democrat, and his Republican adversaries, they hold a large majority, but not quite a supermajority. Well, they hold a supermajority in the Senate, but not in the House. They called themselves into a veto override session, and it was, frankly, they were trying to take a shot at the governor and override some of his vetoes, especially bills. There was an open carry gun bill, and he vetoed an anti-transgender bill, but they failed. It was, in the words of Dizzy Dean from my childhood, a swing and a miss. And they thought they had the votes, and it turns out the governor had the votes he needed. And so it gave, actually, they called themselves in thinking they were going to sort of take a bite out of the governor, and he turned the tables, and it was handed him actually a significant victory.
It seems to me that we had leadership there that just wasn't seasoned. When I think about other leaders that we've had in these positions, whether Speaker of the House or President of the Senate, had they gone in, the outcome would have been, I think, different.
Well, I don't think that's the fault of the particular legislative leaders. I think that's a reflection of term limits. You know, you're going to get people in there who've been there for maybe 8, 9, 10 years, which seems like a long time, but look at the tenure that somebody like John Ilario had, 48 years. You know, I was at one point a promoter or a fan, I should say, of term limits, but I actually think they've been disastrous. I think it's good to have people there who can serve a long time. And frankly, the voters have a chance every 4 years to throw somebody out. And if the voters want to have the same person there for 15, 20 years, you know, that's representative democracy. And there is something to be said for institutional knowledge. You lose institutional knowledge in the body of the House and in the body of the Senate with term limits, and the only institutional knowledge up there is with the staff and the lobbyists. And even a lot of the staff have left because they don't like having to teach everybody the same lessons every 8 or 12 years. It wears you down.
I do believe, and I would go so far as to say I predict, that a number of the issues that were presented in the override session are going to come back.
Oh, yeah. They're going to come back. No doubt about that.
And it's
part of the culture war that we're in,
as
a country.
And what has happened is a lot of these issues have matured in a very quick way, and we've seen what has happened in other areas of the country and what's presently happening relative to a number of these issues.
Sure.
So it'd be interesting to see. Story number five, Bill Cassidy breaks his Trump fever.
Yeah, it's been a real metamorphosis in the last 12 months, actually the last 14 months. Louisiana is a very red state, voted for Trump in both elections, and Bill Cassidy, a Republican senator, was reelected in 2020 in November. But he was one of the first, certainly the first in Louisiana, and one of the first in the country among the Republican senators to say, Joe Biden won. The election was not stolen. And then he voted to convict President Trump in the second impeachment trial. And he said very plainly, I voted guilty because I believe he was guilty. They proved the case. And then he became, on a number of issues, he you know, move back to the middle. I say back because if you look at Bill Cassidy's career, when he was initially a state senator, he was a Republican, but he was a moderate. And before that, he was a Democrat. He spent much of, if not most of, his medical career, he's a physician, working in the charity hospital system. He did that by choice. So he understands public health care. He understands the importance of public hospitals. And he played a major role in the passage of the infrastructure bill. He was one of a handful of Republicans who not only voted for it, but he was in the room where it happened. He helped negotiate the final product. And so it made him a real player. He's become kind of a John Breaux figure. If you think back 20 years ago and longer, former U.S. Senator John Breaux was a major deal maker because the Senate back then was very close. And he was a guy who could, you know, work, talk to both sides and tilt it one way or the other. And that gave him a lot of power. And I think Cassidy has that kind of power right now. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what he does with that.
Now, there's no doubt, and most recently an article talking about whether or not he has an interest in running for governor and whether or not that would bode well coming from the opposite side of the John Bel Edwards victory, but being more center, more moderate.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if our state, like many states, is polarized, but I think a lot of people are frustrated with the polarization, and it'll be interesting to see if someone who runs in the middle from either party could land a runoff spot. The irony is that the middle usually gets squeezed in the primary, but if someone in the middle makes it to the runoff, that person inevitably wins.
Yeah. I said this right before you came on, Clancy, that the folks that keep trying to reconstitute Donald Trump as a candidate in 2024, I think, is doing the Republican Party a disservice, in my view. It's time to move on. The fact of the matter is there's too many things. And this really, it's just about how caustic he became during his presidency as to whether or not anything could get done. And I really think it really stymies the party to just be all in.
Yeah, the Republican Party today is not a party. It's operating more like a cult. And the problem is, it's not so much, and I'm not defending Donald Trump, but I think politically the problem isn't, quote, the problem that Republican officials have in Congress and in the Senate, because privately they don't like Trump. They see him for what he is, and they share the same views that you just expressed. But the Republican voters like Trump, and as long as he's getting in the 60s or even close to 70% support among Republican voters, the public officials are too scared to do anything. They got to follow where the base is. And so I think as this year goes on and there are investigations out there, if any of them yield anything that is particularly damaging to Donald Trump and he falls into the 50s, especially if he gets to the low 50s, then you're going to see some things change. But until that happens, I don't think the Republican elected officials are going to move.
I really believe it's more about delivery. I think people really, for Republicans, they're tired of talking around issues, right? And they just talk to the issue. And
but I think the end result is the same. If he gets down into the 50s, that's where it's going to change. For whatever reason.
I don't disagree with you. In fact, I totally embrace your theory. But what I think it is more for Republicans is that they're tired of sound bites. They want to hear and they want to see action back up what you're actually saying. And in that respect, Donald Trump was very much an anomaly. He said it, and then he went about trying to institute what he said. And, you know, it's just not lip service. And I think that's what really caught on for people with him. And I give the example of immigration. When he outlined his immigration policy in Phoenix, Arizona during the election, and I have been one that has followed immigration policy, sat on national committees of the Sheriff's Association, and was very much in tune to it, was the first time that I saw that a policy rolled out actually made sense. But I had the same suspicion. I'm not so sure he's going to do anything about it. But he did. And, you know, and it was, I've heard a lot of people talk about it, but I've not heard many people do something about it.
Yeah.
And I think that has brought good favor for him from the voter and a loyalty that a lot of people don't understand. And,
mm-hmm.
I think it just comes right back to, I don't want lip service, I want action.
Yeah.
Now, we can agree or disagree on whether or not it's the right thing or the wrong thing, but they found in him one who said it and then went out and did it.
But, yeah, if people who support that policy are very pleased, that's one of the things they cite, and they talk about how he took a tough stance on China, but... You know, he also talked about Infrastructure Week, and it was mostly an infrastructure minute that never went anywhere. Yeah. And it's ironic that all the Republicans in Congress who wanted to, you know, get behind Trump's infrastructure program voted against pretty much a similar program of infrastructure under Joe Biden. It's just politics. Nobody wants the other side to have a victory,
yeah.
And they'd rather see the country go in the ditch than have the other side get something done.
No, no doubt. Let's get to the next story, the City Hall relocation fight. That was one that kind of came out of left field and shocked me.
Yeah, in terms of the fact that it became an issue, because
yeah,
what shocked me is that the mayor stuck with it as long
yeah.
as she did. The handwriting was on the wall almost from day one, but I think she, I hope for her sake and the city's sake that she's over it, and I think there is some movement behind the scenes right now for there to be a multi-partisan, not just bipartisan, but a multi-party approach, the mayor, the council, the neighborhood, people talking about, okay, what's next? How do we solve this? Because the problem didn't go away. We do need a new city hall, and we need to do something with municipal auditorium. And they don't have to be joined together. They can be two separate things, but they can do more than one thing at a time. And I think I'm kind of optimistic that we'll get something done there. But that was a big story, and it was a big victory for neighborhood associations, not just in Treme, but especially Treme. But they were helped by neighborhood associations across the city.
Oftentimes, and I think you would agree with this, if you want to affect change, you do so at a grassroots level. You don't just simply rely on political leadership.
Absolutely. Real change comes from the bottom up.
Yeah. And, you know, it was interesting about that, and you didn't say this, but one thing is we got to make sure we don't lose the FEMA money. I mean, it's a gift.
That's right.
You know, we need to make sure that we maximize that gift
right.
We do what's necessary. Now, the next story is one that just seems like it does not go away, and it grew to be much greater than just LSU main campus, these
yes.
Title IX scandals.
Yeah, just scandals in general, but LSU's Title IX scandal, and this is sort of where the Me Too movement, where the rubber meets the road, you know, this is where it really gained traction, because before it was individuals, you know, when you go back to Harvey Weinstein and Weinstein and various people like that, it was an entire institution just not doing what it was supposed to do. And there was that very damning report made by an independent attorney who really knows Title IX stuff. And he went in there and just pulled the lid off and told it like it is. And it was a very damning report on LSU and its handling of Title IX from top to bottom. The system was wrong. The people implementing it were not doing it. And it just, they needed to have a house cleaning at LSU, and I haven't seen that yet. But they really need to, and it really brought the women of the legislature together, Republicans and Democrats, among women legislators who rarely vote the same way, were speaking with one voice. They were all 100% of them together on this, and they flexed some serious muscle on that. And then you had other scandals too, from Irvin Mayfield being sentenced to jail, and former St. Tammany Sheriff Jack Strain being convicted. The FBI raided the plumbing department at the Sewage and Water Board, mostly looking at a small handful of people. It was not a system-wide scandal, but there were some people there that the Fed suspected doing some bad things. And, of course, the never-ending saga of the Hard Rock Hotel collapse. There were plenty of scandals. And there always are, as you say. This is a never-ending story.
And in many respects, this Title IX issue kind of contributed to the bringing down of the coach at LSU. And I was kind of surprised at the insular culture there.
LSU has been accused of having that. You know, LSU used to be the 800-pound gorilla of Louisiana politics. That started ending about 20 years ago. And this past year, they became a punching bag. And they really need there's some institutional inertia there that needs to get moving and get moving in the right direction.
Because when you look at the change in the last 365 days, a lot of big positions have flipped, right?
I mean, but there are also some key positions that didn't.
Right.
But we'll see. We'll see. We'll see if time will tell, and we'll see if this is just a lip service or if there's really going to be some changes. Because there needs to be. I raised two sons, one of whom went to LSU. But if I had a daughter right now in high school, I wouldn't want her to go to LSU. And I hate to say that. My wife graduated from LSU. My son went to LSU undergrad and law school. My youngest son. So, and they both got great education. So they need to project that this is a safe place to send your kids. And they need to work on that intensely, and not just for a year, but going forward for all time.
You know, they're difficult times right now, obviously, to manage and otherwise, but that just calls upon to have a lot more internal checks and balances that have to be monitored daily.
Title IX already requires that. They just need to follow the rules and implement them.
Exactly. All right, we got to get to another break. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. We're visiting with Clancy Dubose, political editor and columnist for Gambit and WWL-TV, political analyst. We're talking about the top 10 stories of 2021. We will be right back. Stay with us, folks. We're visiting with Clancy Dubose. We've got to get through the rest of this fairly quickly, Clancy. Elections have consequences.
Excuse me, yes, I'll do this real quick. I'll just take it and run with it. Troy Carter won his election to Congress. That was a big thing, and that's had big local implications because he stays involved in local politics. We had 5 new city council members elected in New Orleans at the end of the year. That's going to make a big change. One of those 5 new ones is really 4.5 because Oliver Thomas was a council member before, and he's one of the 5 5 non-incumbents joining the city council. And it's going to be interesting to see how the council and the mayor get along. And for the good of the city, let's hope that they do get along. And then the next one, number 9, utility regulation, is always a big story, but it's not one that a lot of people get their arms around because it always involves numbers and technical stuff. But here's some numbers to think about. Entergy Louisiana, which is outside New Orleans and much of Louisiana, is facing $2.5 billion in costs to rebuild its transmission grid after the last 2 hurricane seasons. And locally in New Orleans, Entergy New Orleans has to rebuild and harden its dysfunctional distribution system after Ida. That's going to cost at least $125 million with an M. And Entergy New Orleans also has to rebuild its reputation with voters and the city council regulators after some embarrassing failures in recent years. And then the last one, number 10, not quite the last one, but the last one plus 2, I call it Mitch Gets His Groove Back. Mitch Landrieu landed a sweet gig as the director and overlord of Joe Biden's $1.2 trillion infrastructure program. I think his biggest challenge is going to be managing expectations, because I think a lot of folks in Louisiana say, oh, great, we got the guy up there, we can get all this money. It's not going to work that way. I'm sure that bill that passed has all sorts of checks and balances and requirements and paperwork, and it's really going to be interesting to see how fast he can start giving that money away, because, as you know, Newell, as a former public official having to deal with FEMA after several hurricanes, the money doesn't flow. And look at what's happening in the Bayou country and in the river parishes. Ida was 4 months ago, and the money's still not coming. So the federal government is not a spigot. So I think Landrieu's going to have a tough time managing the expectations with all that money. But if he can cut through the bureaucratic red tape and start getting money to projects that are, as they say, shovel-ready, not just in Louisiana but around the country, it will give him a pretty good national profile. Yep. So that's the top 10, and I'll quickly you talk got, about the, but what, the plus but two.
I always say is that you got to be in a position to receive. Consider the following. We still got this money for the jail, hadn't been spent. We still got this money for the municipal auditorium, hasn't been spent. All this road work that you see where we started these projects and then they disappear, that was just to get the time, you know, hit the deadlines.
Hit the deadline and then we haven't spent. Reset the clock.
Yeah, exactly. All right, plus two more, casino referendum.
St. Tammany had a barn burner of a referendum. I think it was close to $5 million that was spent, most of it by the proponents at Pacific Peninsula Entertainment, or P2E, as they're known. They had everybody from Drew Brees to my old friend John False, a famous restaurateur chef, and lots of others touting the benefits of the new casino. And it went down to defeat in a parish-wide referendum in St. Tammany because the Constitution requires a local referendum to change gambling. And it was 63% voted against it. And the interesting thing about it is it failed in 90% of the precincts. There's 170 precincts in St. Tammany. Only 17, which is exactly 10%, voted yes. And most of those were pretty close. So it wasn't just like some people said, oh, the Slidell area is going to be going to be against it, but the people in Western St. Tammany are going to be for it because they don't have to put up with all the bad results or bad things that might come from it. It was just the opposite. It was all across the parish. People voted no in large numbers, and a few precincts, most of them, frankly, in the Slidell area, but it was pretty close in most of them. Yeah.
Proposed sales tax reform goes down, but tax
reform. You and
I
talked about that many times. There was a constitutional amendment to change the way that Louisiana businesses report and pay their sales taxes. Very hotly debated. It lost narrowly, 52-48. And the interesting thing there is Mayor Cantrell, this was one of her victories. She came out against it, and the city of New Orleans voted against it by a margin of a little over 16,000 votes, and it failed statewide by about 15,000 plus. So the city of New Orleans made the difference. But there's going to be some payback when the legislature goes back in session. You know, the speaker and the Senate president both wanted that bill to pass. It was the speaker's bill. But then again, look at this. You just have to tell the truth and look at the facts. It also failed in the speaker's home parish. So you could argue that they should have made – they knew Cantrell was against it. They needed to make it up around the other parts of the state. Like you said earlier, this is going to be one of those issues that comes back. Yeah. And I think maybe they'll get it better, hopefully.
But they got a lot, they got
was,
a lot of work.
Consensus behind it.
They've got a lot of work to do for sure.
Thank you
so much for joining us. Always
Thank
enjoy
you,
the
Neil.
Conversation, and I know that we'll be talking shortly as the new council comes in, and we'll see what their agenda will be. We'll be right back, folks. That's Clancy Dubose, political editor and columnist for Gambit and WWL-TV, political analyst. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s?
It's better over here.
Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.